We are talking today with Kate Brown. Kate Brown is Associate Professor of History at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She has published articles in the American Historical Review, Chronicle of Higher Education, Harper's Online Edition, Critica, Slate Magazine, and the Times Literary Supplement. She is the author of A Biography of No Place, From Ethnic Borderland to Soviet Heartland, winner of the American Historical Association's George Lewis Beer Prize for the best book in international European history. And she is here to talk about her new book, Plutopia, Nuclear Families, Atomic Cities, and the Great Soviet and American Plutonium Disasters. Kate, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Mike, for having me.
So to start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing Plutopia?
Well, I wrote a book about that ended up in the Chernobyl period, about a book about Ukraine. And it's about this, how this multi-ethnic borderland in 25 years has no ethnic minorities at all. The Jews, the Germans, Belarusians, and Poles were all gone. And then 25 years later, everybody is gone. It's the Chernobyl zone of alienation. And after I wrote the book, I took a sort of a week summer holiday in the Chernobyl zone, and I wrote an article about it. And an editor contacted me and asked me to write a whole book about Chernobyl. And I thought, yeah, there are a lot of books already about Chernobyl. And I started sniffing around, and I realized there were two places that had 2 to 4 times more spilled radiation than Chernobyl, and nobody had ever really heard of them. Hanford, of course, is well-known in Washington state, but not much outside of Washington. And then there's this Mayak, which is in southern Russian Urals, and it's the answering plutonium plant for the Soviets. And I thought about that. You know, Chernobyl's a household word, but very few people have heard about Mayak and Hanford, and I wondered why. And the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, Chernobyl and Fukushima were sort of camera-ready events. They occurred in one day, they blew up, the cameras were running, and they played out in a couple of weeks as big media events. Hanford and Mayak were different. They occurred behind this military barricades. They had they occurred over 4 decades, and there were no accidents. I mean, there were accidents, but not really big ones. The real catastrophe occurred by design. These were intentional, daily dumping of radioactive waste into the air, the ground, and the water. And that, to me, was a chilling realization, because I thought, there's tens of thousands of workers who've gone through these big factories, and they all were witnesses. Not one of them said anything until the 1980s. And I thought, how did that happen? How could you have this place where this kind of disaster, the slow-motion disaster, is going on, and nobody speaks up about it? And I couldn't, how did they get people to do that? So I started looking into it, and I realized that both places had these limited-access cities exclusively for plant operators. That's Richland in eastern Washington, and the Russian equivalent of Richland is called Oziorsk. It was first called Chelyabinsk 40. It was a code name to trip up the CIA. And I think the key to this complicity of silence, this conspiracy of silence, was these exclusive cities, which I call Plutopia. They're plutonium utopias, which were set up so that working class plant operators could live and get paid like the upper classes. And in that way, they started to align themselves with their bosses and their superiors in really sort of strange and mystifying ways.
So how did the both of these facilities come about, both Hanford and Mayak?
Well, I tell this story as a sort of a tandem history going back and forth between the American landscape and the Soviet landscape. And there are some surprising similarities, because considering the great vast differences between these two countries. Leaders in both countries, and these are military leaders who ran these places, thought that they would build these vast factories with militarized labor living in camps, and that's how they set it up. And so at Hanford, they had Camp Hanford. It was 60,000 people living in barracks, and they brought in migrant workers from all over the country to build this vast plant. And these mostly guys, but also single women, boozed and brawled and, you know, ran off and had sex in really sort of alarming ways. In Russia, the same thing. They brought in Gulag prisoners, German POWs, deportees, ethnic deportees from other parts of the countries, and they set them to work building this vast plant. And they boozed and brawled and had sex and were disobedient in very similar ways. And that really struck these military leaders. I mean, they realized that when they staffed these plutonium plants, once they had them built, they could not have workers who were as volatile as the product they were about to make. You can imagine like a brawl or a fist fight or a strike at a plutonium plant. If somebody has some Luddite action and starts banging on the equipment, that terrified them. They were terrified of these working class people. They really didn't like them much. So they decided that the solution to securing nuclear weapons would be the nuclear family, strangely enough. And so they set up these special towns where they had workers who were embedded in their nuclear families, living in these atomic cities, people who were paid well, whose families became dependent on this one product. And that bought a lot of complicity and loyalty and silence. And so these places were federally subsidized. People lived in these remote settings, sort of rural and sparsely located, where the surrounding population were poor farmers who lived kind of hand to mouth. If you can think of Eastern Washington in the 40s and 50s, certainly the Soviet countryside was virtually impoverished for the 50s and the 60s. These places lived well. They had freestanding houses in Richland. People got 30% more pay, fantastic schools with PhDs teaching in them, wonderful recreational programs, and everything was very affordable. People rented houses for maybe $35 a month. Across the river in Pasco, in the Pasco ghetto where African Americans had to live, they paid $100 a month for a shack with no plumbing, a spigot, and the dirty, mud fence outside. Same thing in Russia. They had this gated city, walled off from the rest of the community, walled off from the camp, the Gulag camps and the garrisons of soldiers. Inside that gated community, you could buy Finnish overcoats and German shoes and Romanian plums, chocolate and sausage, unheard of luxuries in the Soviet provinces in the 40s and 50s. Locals started calling them the chocolate people, just like they called Richland the Gold Coast. And, and outside of this Azurs, this gated community, were gritty industrial settlements with names like Asbestos and Asbestos II, where people, bought gray macaroni and then stood in line for that gray macaroni and then went home to their dugout hovels, stooping and coughing as they went in. Their kids went to the second and third shift of overcrowded schools, and they started working when they were 12. So these special communities, these plutopia, bought working class people in these child-centered communities a chance for social mobility and the kind of life that they never expected to lead in their lifetimes.
And did they only have that while they were working there, or did they have people that moved out of that and still retained their social mobility?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what you find in these towns is a certain kind of fear. And it's not a fear of the bomb plant blowing up, and it's not a fear of being bombed by the enemy. Those were very legitimate fears, but people don't tend to, I don't see any evidence that they harbored them much. Instead, their biggest fear is getting tossed out of this plutopia, this Garden of Eden. So in Richland, parents worried that their kids might misbehave and get a ticket from the police, and that might be grounds for the father or the breadwinner of the family to be fired from the plant. And everybody knew if you got fired, you had a month to move out of Richland and lose all these privileges that living in Richland entailed. If you did something wrong at the plant, if you said to your boss, "I think these conditions in which we're working are particularly dirty," that would be grounds for termination. Same thing in Azursk. If, a worker drank too much, slept with other men's wives, that was taken up at party meetings, and they threatened people with eviction. If your kid dressed like Elvis Presley and listened to the Voice of America, that kid was sent to boarding school outside the gated community and could never return. And parents were okay with that. They let their kids go because they so wanted to stay in this Eden. There was a big explosion in 1957 at the Soviet plant, an underground waste tank, the same kind of tanks they're having problems with now out in Hanford. overheated and blew, and it blew 20 million curies of radioactive waste into the air, created a big cloud of fallout, ash and fallout, and it was hard to hide. And people who lived in the city started to get nervous, and they started resigning from the plant and leaving. But after a couple of months, I find all these letters of people requesting to come back. They said, we can't live out here in the big world. It's too difficult. I was stupid. Please take me back. And I think for me, the message for that is that they preferred the risks of living in their plutopia to, you know, and this, the, you know, the certainty of being fed and living well, to the possible risks of putting themselves and their families in danger.
Now, did they know when they were living there of the risks that are evident today from nuclear materials?
Yeah, there was a lot of minimizing of the risks, and a lot of, you know, real men don't worry about radiation. There's a lot of, you know, machismo and this sort of relativism and minimizing. So you'd hear if you lived in Richland that it was more dangerous to operate your household appliances than to work in a plutonium plant. You would hear that a lot about background radiation in Denver, right? And that radiation is a part of normal part of life. Now, this is, of course, manufactured. This plutonium is a was a man-made product, the most volatile product humankind has ever made, and there's nothing natural about it. And there's nothing natural about the tens of millions of gallons of radioactive waste that come from irradiating 100 tons of uranium, processing it down to a few kilograms of plutonium to make a nuclear bomb. Plutonium plants are the messiest stop in the assembly line for nuclear weapons, and these plants generated a great deal of waste. Part of the reason, this is going to your question about what people knew, is that there wasn't a lot of talk about this waste, and there wasn't a lot of focus on it. They spent more on the Richland annual school budget than they spent on dealing with radioactive waste in the 50s. And so they did what humans do with waste. They buried it. They dug holes in the ground and poured in medium-level waste. They put low-level waste in the river, and they took high-level waste, and they dug holes, made tanks, and stuck it in the tanks. Those were temporary solutions when they came up, but they knew this could not be a long-term solution. Now, 60 years later, we still have those same tanks that are leaking and heading towards the aquifers and heading towards the Columbia River. And these temporary solutions have become semi-permanent, and it seems almost unfixable. To this day, we have no technological solutions to what to do with that waste.
And again, you mentioned the explosion in 57 with a tank there. Were they basically having the same problems and doing the same things we were here?
Yeah. They didn't spend much on waste. They didn't invest much in it. In fact, 1949, the Soviets are racing to catch up with the Americans in terms of the number of bombs, right? They started their project in 1945, right after Hiroshima. 2 weeks later, the Soviets get a hold of an Air Force bombing map targeting, you know, these new nuclear weapons, who would be possibly bomb. And they realize that there are 50 Soviet cities on that map. Now, it's 1945, August 1945. The Soviets and Americans are still allies. This was, you know, shocking. So the Soviets feel we need to build a nuclear shield, as they call it. We need to do it yesterday. And so they set about what they think they're doing is securing the nation from an imminent American nuclear apocalypse, you know, attack that would create nuclear apocalypse in the Soviet Union. So this is something that really can't wait. And so in 1949, they've built these underground tanks. They're following the American model. And they run out of tanks. And so they could stop production and build new tanks and then start producing again. But that would slow down their production of weapons. So they decide to keep producing and to dump that high-level waste instead into the T'cha River. Now, unlike the Columbia River, the T'cha River is a slow, turgid, muddy river that gets bogged down in a number of swamps and lakes on its way downriver, where 28,000 people were living directly on the river. They had no wells, and they were drinking from this river, bathing in it, fishing in it, swimming in it, irrigating their crops and their livestock in this river. They didn't know in 49 this was happening, and only in 1951 did they go down and with some Geiger counters and take some measurements. And the scientists who went there were horribly shocked. The kids everything was radiated, the cooking supplies, the kitchens, the homes, the food, and the bodies of the people who lived there. The kids' stomachs were dangerous sources of radiation. So they set about evacuating 10 out of 16 of the villages on the river. But that was a very slow process. It took about 10 years. And they left a number of villages there, the biggest ones, probably because it was expensive to move them, the bigger ones, and to rebuild facilities for them elsewhere. But over time, in the 60s, they thought, oh, this is kind of a natural experiment. We're going on the third generation of people living on contaminated territory. It'd be interesting to know what happens to people living on contaminated territory. So they started showing up, doctors started showing up every year, taking blood samples. When they developed them, running people through whole body scanners, taking readings of the ambient environment for radiation, radioactive contamination. And they have this amazing database now, which they sell. You know, they advertise, we have the only three-generational cohort of people living on radiated territory. And if you want to buy our medical data sets, you know, pожалуйста, you can have it. But the people who lived there, of course, did not know about this until after Chernobyl. And now they have political organizations called the White Mice, for instance, where they feel like they were left there to be tested. And that's a suspicion they have, and there might be something to it. So what they got was something that so far has been diagnosed only in the Russian Urals, and it's called chronic radiation syndrome. And it's a syndrome that comes from long-term exposure to low doses of radiation. And a body eventually comes up with cancers with this kind of exposure, but long before you get cancer, people get symptoms such as chronic fatigue, anemia, severe anemia, diabetes, problems with the circulation system and the circulatory system and digestive tracts. Kids, people have trouble with fertility, and the kids, their offspring, have all kinds of birth defects, autoimmune disorders, and so on and so on. So what happens is there's a whole community of people, and for instance, Muslimova, still living there on the Tchar River, who just don't feel right. And their kids are minimally functioning. And when I would show up, they would offer me a meal. There are no jobs in this community because how can you have any kind of thriving economy in radiated territory? So they're farming. They're living off the land, which takes on new meaning in contaminated ground. And they offer you goose and veal and cucumbers and potatoes and tomatoes, none of which you can eat. And so that's the real tragedy about these places. And I think in the American context with the downwinders, if you go to those communities, they have very many of the same complaints that these people in Muslimova have, that Russian doctors have diagnosed as chronic radiation syndrome. Now, chronic radiation syndrome is too vague of a complaint to really hold up in an American court if you were going to sue a corporation for contamination. What you need is a singular disease that can be clearly traced to a singular radioactive isotope. So iodine in the air, iodine in the thyroid, thyroid disease, thyroid cancer. That's a rock-solid case. But vague complaints from a number of different kinds of radioactive isotopes that are synergistically working with DDT in the environment and other chemicals, we don't have the kind of sophisticated medical science to even evaluate that. And scientists who've done mostly work in labs, not among populations, haven't even really asked those questions in the American landscape. And that's one of the strange things about the story, is that there are some uses to a closed society. The Americans at Richland and at the Hanford labs were nervous about asking questions about what happened to the downwinders when they're breathing in all this, you know, from the Green Run, for instance, you know, 11,000 curies of radioactive iodine. What happens next? They can't ask these questions because they're worried, as they say, about undue alarm, public hysteria. They talk about not the threat of radiation, but the threat of public exposure. Not exposure to radiation, but exposure to, you know, the public finding things out. So as one official put it when I asked why these studies of downwinders were never carried out in the 60s, they said, well, what if we found something out? The Soviet case is not an open society. There's no independent press. So the doctors were freer to ask open-ended scientific questions about these populations, secure what, and then what they thought would be the knowledge that nobody would ever open their classified medical records. Of course, after when the Soviet Union fell apart, these records were opened, and we find all these, you know, what they call data sets of people who've been living long-term on these places. And in many ways, a more sophisticated understanding of what radiation does to the human body long before cancer manifests itself.
Talk more about the Green Run.
Mm-hmm. So the premise of writing about these two towns together is that they're very much in conversation with each other throughout the Cold War. Hanford is created. Oziorsk is its, or the Mayak plant is its answer. And their two are like, they used to say in Oziorsk that if you drilled a hole straight in through the earth, you would end up in Richland. And that's how I see them, as two cities that are rotating on an axis around the globe. And they're, one plant builds more reactors, the other plant has to answer with more reactors and more processing plants and more plutonium. So in 1949, August of 1949, the Soviets tested their first bomb. In Kazakhstan, Semipalatinsk. Americans had, pilots circling the globe with air filters there to detect just this eventuality. And so they knew right away that the Soviets had tested this bomb, and they were shocked because they didn't think the Soviets would have a bomb for maybe 10, maybe 20 years. They underestimated the Soviets greatly. So they're scared by this. Terrified. What are we going to do? We need to know how much the Soviets are producing, how much plutonium they've got going there. They guessed, quite rightly, that in a hurry, the Soviets would produce bombs with green fuel, meaning that they, when you irradiate uranium fuel cells, the safest thing to do is to put them in a pool of water for 3 months so that they can decay. The short-lived radioactive isotopes, like radioactive iodine, can decay. But if you're in a hurry, you don't got 3 months. So you do more like 30 days. And then you get what's called green fuel. This is very dirty radioactive fuel that then you process through the plants. As you process it through the plants, radioactive gases and much higher concentrates of radioactivity go up through the stacks and spread into the environment. And one can detect them on the global pathways, airways. So that's what the Americans were probably trying to do when they ran the Green Run in November, just 2 months after the Soviet test of 1949, out at Hanford. They processed green fuel, and the whole experiment went wrong. They would like to have waited for weather that was clear with the wind, picking up, lofting, and dispersing this radioactive gas widely across the landscape. But instead, they set a day when the winds were drafting down towards the earth, and on top of that, there was a rain that was bringing the gases right down to the ground. They tried to track this. It was about 11,000 curies of radioactive iodine that came out that day out of the stacks. They tried to track it, but they found that their filters clogged up, that their planes got lost. But they did notice that there was just as much radioactivity in Walla Walla, 60 miles away, as there was right next to the plant stacks. And what they found is that rather than radioactive waste dispersing evenly across the landscape in some diffuse pattern, so everywhere there'd just be a little bit of radioactivity and that wouldn't hurt anyone, what they found is that radioactivity and goes with the pathways of either the ground, or the water, or the air to certain spots repeatedly, creating what they called hot spots. So Walla Walla, places in Walla Walla tended to be hot spots. Places on, upslopes of valleys tended to have hot spots. And if you were unfortunate enough to be in those spots, you were in places where the radioactivity had concentrated rather than being diffuse. And so there are a lot of people who feel like the Green Run, especially if they're young at the time and they were in some of these pathways, they feel like the Green Run was the cause of some of their problems with thyroid cancer, thyroid disease, and other maladies that they've had.
I've interviewed downwinders who lived in Walla Walla at the time, and one of the women there took us to a cemetery there that they have specific baby cemeteries, and you can just see like dozens of these babies that died in the same range, in the same time period. That seems highly unusual to me.
Yeah. So I saw that, and there was a similar, very similar Spokane cemetery. Same kind of thing. About 30% of a 150-year-old cemetery, 30% of the bodies in there are babies from the 50s. So I asked a grad student of mine to run a study of the census of Benton and Franklin counties around Richland. And from 1950 to 1949, she found that there was this big spike in infant mortality. That's children dying within their first years of life in exactly Franklin and Benton counties, and especially in Richland. Now, I find it strange that here, 50 years later, I'm the first one to uncover this. And I think that reveals the sort of lack of curiosity about public health around this plutonium plant that has been manifest all these years, because to find out too much would be a problem.
And yet it seems from your earlier statement about how if the Soviets were doing something that the Americans responded, oh, we've got to do that. If they're doing this testing on their own people, you'd think the Americans would have said, well, we've got to do testing on our people, too.
Yeah, you would have thought. And it's true that in the 1960s, the Americans, the Hanford labs, you know, they were starting to the plant closed really about 1964. They ceased to produce much plutonium after 1964. And they moved the plutonium production facilities more to Savannah River in Georgia. And they're looking for something to do to keep these people employed in these, you know, nice houses. At this point, by 1960, the people in Richland had bought their own houses, and they didn't want to be living in a ghost town and lose their investment in their real estate, which is usually an American family's major investment. So they were desperate to have another economy to depend on. And one of those was, in fact, research in the Hanford lab. So they did start doing, for the first time, research on what they called human subjects around the area. And they developed a whole body counter, and they went around and like a community at Ringgold, right across the river from the plant, a small farming community. They ran a study in the early 60s. There was only 20 people in the study. And two kids in the study come out with very high counts of radioactive iodine in their bodies. But even when they find that, they say, you know, the gratifying result of the study is we only found two kids out of 20 with high counts. So even when they did very small and limited studies, they still were sort of Pollyannas about looking at the results of these studies or looking any farther. And what they tended to do is come up with research programs that generated income but didn't have much medical value. Like one of these was the prisoner testes study in Walla Walla at the state penitentiary. 1962, there was a criticality accident, and three guys were exposed to the blue light of a small, a limited chain reaction. They got very sick from it. They were put in the shielded hospice, special hospital ward. You know, doctors in spacesuits treated them because these guys were so radioactive for a time after their exposure. And one of the things they discovered is that these guys all lost their sperm and became infertile for a period of time after this accident. And you can see this is a factory full of men and a lab full of male scientists, and this made them very nervous. And so they wanted to find out, you know, what this was and why this was caused and if they could reverse it. And so they came up with this prisoner testes study where they went to Walla Walla and they got volunteer prisoners, paid them $5, and then set up a special bed in which the men laid face down, and then their testes were submerged in, you know, body temperature water, and then they shot them from both sides with x-rays. And they started at 2 rads, no sperm. They went up to 4 rads, no sperm. They kept going higher and higher to 60 rads. This is a 12-year study with no change in the results. And I asked a lot of times, like, what's the medical value of continuing to go higher and higher on these guys when you know that they're not going to have any sperm after 2 rads? Why go to 60? And why do it for 12 years? And the only answer I can come up with is that it was a lucrative government grant for a long-term study. Two professors, one at University of Washington, another one at University of Oregon, ran the study. They worked with Hanford Labs, and the people at Hanford Labs were very nervous about this. And nobody wanted to press the button to zap the testes. You know, you press it. No, you press it. They're going back and forth in the correspondence because nobody wanted to be liable. because they realized that there was something a little fishy about the study. And so finally they have prisoners press the button for each other. They call them inmate technicians. And, you know, later some of the prisoners who came up with cancers and became sick and found this to be very painful said, you know, this inmate didn't like me, and he held the button extra long, right? I mean, there's something highly immoral about the whole project, but yet it went on for 12 years. So that's the kind of medical studies that the Americans were up to.
Did you run across, I'd also heard from people that they remember from when they were kids, maybe they participated in that whole body counter testing. Did that occur anywhere beyond that particular city you mentioned?
Yeah, they went around to the schools, and they had a bus, and in the bus was a whole body counter, and they invited the kids in, and they gave them comic books and lollipops and made it fun. And these kids went through these whole body counters in the farm communities outside, Mesa, for instance, O'Connell, Pasco, and then in Richland itself. And, you know, people remember, and especially the farmers in Mesa and Pasco, they talk about how, you know, they had to go through these whole body counters, and then they had these green books that were distributed by the scientists at the plant, asking them to write down everything they ate, you know, in this crazy detail. And they would sort of laugh about, you know, all that crazy detail. I can't believe we had to do that. And at the time, you know, I think people thought it was maybe a sign that we were being cared for. They're looking after us. And if they find something wrong, they'll tell us. And I think in some ways these studies gave people a sense of assurance that the scientists who know so much, who in our open democratic society are looking after our best interests, would let us know if there were some problems.
You know, there were some parents who said that they were never consulted when their kids were going through those programs at school.
Yeah, remarkable, huh? It yeah. just happened at school without any kinds of releases. Yeah, that's how they just went to the schools and did it. Yeah.
As well as there was another account of saying that for a period of time there, it was households. There would be a drop-off in the morning of empty, like, milk bottles that people would give urine samples into and then put out. And there'd be, you know, the equivalent of the milkman coming by later in the day to pick up the urine bottles.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, when I think about it, you know, here are these Americans living in a thriving democracy. They're making bombs to defend American democracy. Yet in their town, they have no free market. The corporation selects businesses and gives them monopolies. And then since the businesses have monopolies, they make sure they set prices and go around and check prices. So it's sort of like a little bit of a planned economy. There's no free press. They set up GE set up the Richland Villager, and they hired a former Army censor to be the editor. And they, you know, he knew just the kind of stories they wanted, or the PR department at GE just wrote the stories. So there's no free press. There's no local governments because GE set up an advisory council and selected people to be on it, and those people were paid employees and had to be docile. There's no, you know, city hall. There's no town council. There's no mayor. A GE lawyer, you know, ran the town. So there's no local governments, and there's no, you know, freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. People knew quite clearly they could not say what they wanted to say. They couldn't join a political party that would be too far to the left, or they would lose their place in the town. So here are these Americans giving up their basic rights. And they're even giving up their rights over their bodies by putting, you know, willing to put their urine samples on the front stoop every morning, willing to let their kids run through these whole body counters. And so I think one of the compensations for them was they gained in exchange consumer rights. They gained the right to have this cheap, affordable housing, secure pay 30% more than the surrounding counties, and available goods and great opportunities for their kids in these superior schools with these superior recreational programs, all tax-free. Local taxes did not exist. All federally subsidized. And that's sort of a, you know, this notion of a consumer's republic that, you know, all across America in the post-war period, Americans sort of gave up on notions of American egalitarianism and opportunity and equality for all, equal opportunity for everyone, in exchange for moving into limited access, all-white suburbs with and housing that was federally subsidized by the federal government in the form of FHA loans, and then subsidies to build national defense highways out to them from the increasingly blighted inner cities where minorities were left behind. And I think the difference between Pasco, where temporary construction workers lived, and construction workers who were black who lived in Pasco had to live in the Pasco ghetto in a sort of Jim Crow situation, and Richland, the Gold Coast, are epitomize these stark contrasts in all across America between the blighted inner cities, increasingly blighted, and the increasingly all-white affluent suburb. And in that all-white affluent suburb, as in Richland, people believed that everybody lived like them, that the American democracy, that everybody was the same, it was a classless society, and everybody had equal opportunity. They didn't see, because they were cut off from it, and because it was better not to see, the Pasco ghetto on the other side, just as they didn't see the blighted inner cities and think it had anything to do with them. It seemed natural that those people just didn't make the grade. They weren't good enough to get to a place like Richland, where only the chosen few lived. And I think this sort of epitomizes a lot of shifts we find in American society in the post-war years, so that making these kinds of exchange of body rights over one's body and civil rights and freedoms for consumer rights and financial security and national security made sense to a lot of Americans, not just people in Richland.
It seems a bit of that is being, at least karmically, is being balanced out with those who were part of the select few were exposed at a much higher rate than perhaps those people in Pasco, although obviously people in Pasco were exposed as well, at least if they went into the river and or were exposed to things like the Green Run or any releases from Hanford.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, what was your question?
Oh, so it just seems like there's a bit of karma at play there, that those that really benefited financially and felt security are the ones who are now coming forward and trying to, through lawsuits, trying to get compensation for their long-term exposures to the radionuclides coming out of Hanford.
Yeah, and well, you know, most of these downwinders are people who were in the farming communities. People who worked at the plant were monitored, and they wore badges, and their environments were monitored, so it's much easier to reconstruct their exposure. And to say, oh, yeah, that cancer you have could possibly be caused by Hanford exposures, so here's compensation. So workers got compensation at the plant already in the 90s. And, you know, $150,000 was something that came across right away in the 1990s. Downwinders were not monitored. They didn't wear badges. Their ambient environment wasn't monitored. So when they say, my cancer is caused by Hanford, it's much harder to make the case. So once again, there's this divide between the sort of the people who worked at the plants, who agreed to take these risks, who also get compensated for the risks that they take, and then there's this other divide in the farmers who did not agree to take these risks, who did not work at the plant, and who are still not compensated. These downwinder lawsuits have been going on for 25 years. You know, people who are plaintiffs have died of their cancers by now. The plaintiffs' lawyers are in bankruptcy, and the federal government has spent $60 million defending these corporations, because they had vowed to defend them from the start. That was part of the original agreement. And a law firm in Chicago, Kirkland & Ellis, has you know, made a lot of money in fees defending these corporations with taxpayer dollars.
And again, that gets back to what you brought up earlier, is that this is a military-run city and installation, but they doled out most of the work to these contractors that came in and cleaned up, so to speak.
Right. Right. And a lot of the dirty work in both of these places, you know, the people who now in the Fukushima context we call jumpers, were not regular employees, longstanding employees. They were people who came in, worked temporarily, and were sent out to do construction work on, you know, on contaminated ground underneath, you know, the streams of the smokestacks where this yellow plume is coming out that, you know, eroded women's nylons. Those were construction workers. A lot of those construction workers out in eastern Washington were minorities. They did not live in Richland. They lived in North Richland or in Pasco. And they worked for a couple of years, and then maybe they'd move on. And when there was a spill or something that needed to be cleaned up, those people often did it too. They were not monitored. That was part of the, you know, corporate policies. You don't monitor these temporary workers. So they left. You know, there's, you know, probably 300,000 workers who worked in these places left. We don't know. They took with them their ingested radioactive isotopes. They took with them their possible medical complications. So when they tally up the number of workers who were exposed and who are sick at Hanford, that's just a tiny fraction of the people who were actually exposed on the job. And the same thing happened in Russia. They brought in prisoners and conscripted soldiers to do the dirty work of the cleanups. Local farmers had to do cleanup work on this river when they evacuated these places. And those people were never monitored also. So jumpers, temporary workers who served as jumpers, were instrumental in creating a mirage of healthy pink Plutopias.
Did the U.S. use any, in addition to the radioactive experiments they did on the prisoners, did they use prisoners in any other capacity for building Hanford?
Yes, they did. In 1944, they had a what they called a severe labor crisis. This crisis was inspired not only by the fact that it was wartime and workers were in short supply, but also by the fact that they equated a secure labor force with whiteness. So they did not want to hire neither the Army Corps nor DuPont. They did not want to hire African-American workers nor Mexican-American workers. And there was a surplus of both of these categories of workers because, as we know, it was a segregated U.S. Army. So there was 300,000 approved A1 African-American draftees that weren't going into the Army because there was no place for them since they weren't fighting. There was, you know, lots of Mexican-American labor that was organized in farm administration mobile camps to do work, you know, migrant work and for harvests. Those guys could have been called in and to do a lot of this manual labor for the job site, but they didn't want these people. They didn't think they were secure enough. So they finally, NAACP got involved and said, you have to take a minimum quota of 10% of African Americans. So they build a special segregated part of Camp Hanford for the what they called the Negroes at the time. They have separate facilities. They introduce Jim Crow to the Pacific Northwest. But they also build Prison Industries, Inc., a private company, comes and says, listen, we can put up a labor camp right here, and that will help you with your labor force. And so they bring in white conscientious objectors from McNeil Island, set up whole separate facilities, a labor camp for them. They spend several hundred thousand dollars building this thing. And then these guys are used to dismantle Camp Hanford at the end in 1945 to harvest fruits that were left rotting on the vine in this new territory that had been zoned off from the local farmers, and do other kinds of sort of jumper-related work. And it was a very expensive thing to do, and it was all really to avoid hiring minority labor, because minorities were associated with disloyalty or volatility.
So the dismantling of Camp Hanford, that was due to the end of the war? They didn't need the military barracks anymore?
No. They built Camp Hanford right on the plant premises. And so once they started producing plutonium, it's a dirty landscape. And so they needed to get the people out of. They couldn't have 60,000 people living right directly next to these reactors, which could blow. They were brand new. They didn't really know how they would work. And right next to these processing plants. And the processing plants were really the most dirty. You know, they thought the reactors would be sort of more dangerous. But it turns out that the processing plants, where they take irradiated uranium fuel cells and run them through a series of chemical baths to distill away these tiny grams of plutonium, that job was often given in both countries to women, even though those, it turns out, were the dirtiest jobs. And at DuPont, they were saying, well, you know, what do you think? They'd write the Army Corps, maybe, you know, because we're going to make this super poisonous product, we shouldn't hire women who are younger than a menopausal age. And what about fertility problems? What about mutants and monsters and offspring? You know, they would write these letters. They were real nervous about it. When people say, oh, they didn't know much about radiation in the 1940s, that's absolutely not true. They knew a great deal. And they were worried. But because, again, they had this labor crisis, which was an artificial, you know, labor crisis based on notions of class and race and loyalty, they recruited women from across the country and put them in these radiochemical processing plants. And exposed them. And they did the same thing in Russia. They they gendered the physics and the reactors as male and radio processing as female, because in there you have solutions and you pour, you know, two cups into here. It's like cooking, you know. And the women at Hanford, they'd say, you know, the bosses, when they apply for a job, they'd say, do you like to cook or sew? And this one woman told me, she's like, I didn't like to do either, but I said I'd prefer to cook. And they said, okay, then you go to the radio processing plant because there you're measuring potions. And they thought women would be especially good workers because they were very accurate and they were good at, like, following directions specifically, and they didn't ask a lot of questions. That was their notion of women.
And how did they present the job in terms of hazard or risk to the women?
Well, the women said, you know, I was real nervous about going to these places, and they asked a lot of questions about safety. And the men who were the supervisors, and men were supervisors at these places, were sent to Chicago, University of Chicago, and they were given training. And they were taught what the process was. The women were not sent anywhere for training. They were given like a, you know, sort of a 3-week, very brief, you know, this is how to do things, and not given any background about what the chemistry and the physics were to the kinds of processes they were doing. So they were basically made to work in ignorance, and they were hoping that in so doing the women would worry less about what was happening. But they caught right on. There's a woman, Marge de Guerriere, and she told me that, you know, she said those guys, those chemists with their fancy college degrees, they would come to our lab and they would hand us formulas over the threshold. They wouldn't even walk in our labs because they knew it was so dirty. And as I talked to Marge, she was, you know, she had had cancer, you know, all over her body, and she died just a couple months after I interviewed her. So there was sort of a hierarchy of labor, you know, from, you know, working class all the way up to management. And with it was a hierarchy of exposure. The more you knew, the more you could keep yourself safe from exposures. And the less you knew, the more you could blindly stumble into harm's way.
And I have to assume there was no labor unions to protect these people.
There eventually was a nuclear workers labor union that emerged later, and what they seemed to be interested in was, you know, acknowledging, getting the corporations to acknowledge that the workers were working in hazardous environments, not always so much so that they would change the hazardous environments, but it seems more so that they would get them extra pay, hardship pay, that was sort of what the union wanted to deliver to their workers. There was also carpenters' unions, and I found most of those records have disappeared, but I did find some snatches of things where the carpenters' unions are writing in and saying, listen, our guys are out there in these fields working, and they're not being monitored, and they're developing strange sores on their arms, and the doctors tell them not to worry about it, it's not cancer, and but they don't feel very well, and they're having troubles with their lungs. And so there are these issues that are coming up, and the union representatives are worried about them. But union, especially during the war years in the 50s, union representatives did not have access to the plant. They could only meet plant workers outside of the gates. So these big, you know, gated-off factories sort of gave the corporations that ran them a bubble of immunity to do more or less what they wanted to with inside those walls while they ran these plants. And I would argue there's a little bit of that to the cleanup as well.
Talk a bit about those people now outside of Richland, the farmers that are trying to get recognition and are compensation. One of the people in your book is Tom Bailey.
Yeah, when I first met Tom, probably almost everybody in Eastern Washington knows Tom Bailey because he's been a very outspoken proponent of the downwinders. And he's a guy who has the gift of the gab, and he knows just about everybody around, and he spends a lot of time in coffee shops picking up information. And when I first met Tom, I must tell you, I thought he was kind of crazy because he was telling me the most crazy stories about how the feds used to come in beige cars and to the Pasco slaughterhouse and get the organs from our sheep and our cows after they'd been slaughtered, and they'd take them off in these stainless steel dishes. And he would tell me stories about, you know, reverse wells where they dumped in medium-level waste that then went into the shared aquifer. And he would talk about babies born without heads in what he calls the Cancer Mile around Mesa. And I just thought he was, you know, had the gift of the gab, and he sort of was given to exaggerate. But I found, as I did research, that a lot of what Tom told me turned out to be true. I could find evidence of it in the archives. And a lot of what he knew about how the winds sweep up valleys, and he'd say, you know, I ran for public office, and I campaigned among old people because old people vote. And I would go to these communities, and they'd have all kinds of old people, and I'd turn to my friend and say, why don't we have any old people in our communities? And he'd say, well, they all died of cancer. And so Tom said, you know, see, the people who lived up the hillsides, those communities all, you know, got poisoned, and people down in the valleys were safer. And I also thought that sounded very random. But then I found studies that said exactly that. And then Tom would say, I finally realized why I'm okay and all the goody-two-shoes I went to school with are dead. And I said, why? And he said, well, when they were, the parents told them to drink their milk and eat their vegetables, they did. And I snuck off to the store and ate Twinkies and Coke. And I did find an, actually a study in which pigs that were fed a local diet got sick, and pigs that were fed a poor and artificial diet, you know, at Hanford, and, you know, as they did these studies on animals, thrived. So, I mean, it was kind of odd over and over again, these crazy seeming stories of this kind of apparently unreliable narrator turned out to have a good deal of truth.
And it sounds like we finally found a single place where eating Twinkies and Coke are actually the healthy way to go.
As amazing as that sounds.
Disturbing. Talk about where you got the bulk of the information for your book.
Yeah, you know, information is always a problem when you're talking about secret military installations in both Russia and the United States. After the Chernobyl disaster, local populations in both places, and these activists are real heroes, and I think we need to reflect on that, demanded to see the record of contamination in these closed nuclear facilities. And so, activists among the downwinders, and led by some Seattle reporters and some reporters in Spokane, and the New York Times got the Department of Energy to declassify tens of thousands of documents. And the Department of Energy sort of over-declassified, threw all these documents at the foot of these activists, and thinking that they would be intimidated in this welter of technical material, and they would back off. But they didn't. They started reading it, and they got scientists lined up, and they got people with technical information, and they found all these amazing stories in these records. And that really blew apart the Hanford myth of, you know, safety. Same thing happened out in the Russian Urals. Activists got together. They started talking to the people in these villages. They started talking to sort of defecting plant workers who had amazing stories to tell about these accidents, these disasters in 57 and with the T'cha River. And they got them to declassify a fair amount of information. So I used those records that were declassified. And then I would go talk to people. And especially in Russia, people were nervous about talking to me. And I couldn't get into the closed city, so I camped out in a village just outside of the closed city. And I lived in this little hut, and I had to chop my own wood and pump my own water and carry it with a wooden yoke from the well. But I had this modern cell phone, and I would wait for that cell phone to ring, and my contact inside the closed city would call me and say, I'm sending one out to you. And this one's kind of nervous, so I couldn't tell her you were American, so I said you were Estonian. And so we would meet at a third neutral location in a senior center, and I would interview these people, and they would tell me their stories. And some took a look at me and realized I was American and turned around and left. But others were quite brave and courageous and told me what they could of their stories. And a lot of people did because they were sick, and they felt that they had been made sick by these plants and that they had been denied compensation. So they had reasons that they wanted, you know, they had reasons to talk to me, too. They thought that that would be good for them. And so, and I talked to doctors who had done medical research, and I talked to people who had worked as engineers and physicists at the plants. I talked to everybody I could who was willing to talk to me. And so those oral interviews, I would cross-reference with the archival documents and got as close as I could to what I thought was the truth. But I would invite my readers to read it and judge for themselves.
And some of those documents are available, in addition to your book, available online now.
Right. There's the DOE OpenNet, which has, more than 60,000 documents and photographs. And you can just click on them and download these documents and read them for yourself. It's fascinating stuff. And there's more stories to be told if people have the patience to go through them.
And did you find people in the Tri-Cities over at Hanford to be fairly open about this?
Fairly open, but not always, you know, that open. I mean, there's a certain sort of long-lasting boosterism in the Tri-Cities that, you know, we don't have a problem here. And there's a divide between the people in Richland who are seen as sort of cut off from the local farming communities and the local farming communities who are, sometimes can be a bit resentful of Richland and its preeminence in the Tri-Cities. So there's all these tensions going on. So, you know, one time I was invited to a dinner party and then I got disinvited. You know, those kinds of things would go on. And I was working in the Richland that has a local museum and an archive to the museum. I was working in that archive in 2008. I worked on it. In 2009, I showed up again. And the whole archive had disappeared. It had been taken by the feds, as the archivist said, to be vetted for post-9/11, you know, material. And this archive had, like, people's memoirs and family photographs. And I think nothing that would threaten national security. But in the post-9/11 climate, access to information was getting more and more limited each year that I did research on this book.
Right. And finally, what are you hoping will become of your book?
I hope that people will look at this tandem history and see that there are some striking similarities between how easy it was to deny radioactive contamination and the public health effects in both the Socialist Soviet Union and the American democracy, and that despite the vast differences in these two countries and these two political systems, there was something overarching about the nuclear umbrella that created very similar kinds of cultures and social systems and systems of knowledge. And that, so we need to take a really close look at how the demands of nuclear technology and nuclear secrecy and security create systems and communities that are extremely undemocratic and hierarchical, and also create these plutonium disasters, the full impact of which we've yet to really fully digest.
Both figuratively and literally. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Mike, very much.
We've just been talking with Kate Brown. She is author of the new book, Plutopia, Nuclear Families, Atomic Cities, and the Great Soviet and American Plutonium Disasters.